This episode of Daily Drive is brought to you by TradeRev, the digital dealer-to-dealer auction platform revolutionizing automotive sales. Give your auction inventory a fast, one-way ticket off your lot with TradeRev, a car global company.
Welcome to Daily Drive. I'm Steve Schmidt with Automotive News, filling in this week for Jason Stein. It's Thursday, July 23rd. The 2015 North American International Auto Show in Detroit included more than 40 production and concept introductions. That year, Ford revealed the next generation of its GT supercar. Acura introduced a new NSX, and Volvo unveiled the S60 Inception, at the time representing the first China-made vehicle in the United States from a major automaker. Also on display, a massive 3D printer, quietly and methodically building the local motor Strati, a two-seat electric vehicle with an estimated top speed of 40 miles per hour. According to David Wassner, Executive Vice President of Corporate Development and Regulatory Affairs for Local Motors' parent company, LM Industries, the company was printing at a rate of about 30 pounds per hour back in 2015. Today, the company can print anywhere from 180 to 200 pounds per hour. That was just 5 years ago. Along the way, the company has continued to push the boundaries of 3D printing, incorporated autonomous and cognitive technology into OLLI, its low-speed shuttle, and deployed the vehicle through a number of public-private partnerships worldwide, while also building consumer trust in self-driving technologies. What has the company learned along the way? What's going on with regulations surrounding AVs and 3D-printed automotive components? What can others learn from Local Motors' journey? We've reached David at his home office in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, David. Thanks for joining us on Daily Drive. And good to hear your voice. How are you?
I'm good, Steve. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to talk with you this afternoon.
So let's hop right in. Local Motors, OLLI, and autonomous for all of us. Many respects, that relies on consumer trust and AV technology. And I think many believe that the verdict is still out, whether consumers trust autonomous technologies or not. Talk a little bit about OLLI's deployments around the world, what you're learning from those in terms of building consumer trust, and any lessons learned you might give to others that are working in this space.
Yes, Steve. So let's unpack that. I think there are a number of pieces and a couple of thoughts to get us started. I think consumer trust starts with really how you frame aspects of the question around autonomous vehicles. I think there are a number of surveys that various industry think tanks have done that when you ask people whether they trust a driverless vehicle versus a self-driving vehicle, you get different responses. So I think part of building, you know, consumer acceptance and educating consumers is to also use terminology that is, one, reflective of the state of the technology, but also things that provides comfort to the consumer. So I think that's one way of starting the whole conversation around consumer education and consumer trust. The other thing related to our efforts with deploying OLLI and what we've been on the record on since, and I personally have been on the record on since when we started the OLLI project in late 2015 and into 2016, is that we felt that low-speed autonomy in limited domains with a safety operator is most likely the most risk-averse and safest path to level 4, level 5 autonomy. And that's the path we followed, not just in the United States, but across Europe, Australia, the Middle East, as we deploy our shuttles at universities, hospitals, and business parks. And through that, not only have we worked with, you know, consumers and riders, but we've also educated local government officials, local business leaders, and, you know, the overall community, not just the rider, of what we're really doing and what the future of this technology looks like. So I think in terms of answering the third point of your question, which is what advice would I give to others, is start with the things that we can do now and continue to build. So we've advocated for, you know, a principle of crawl, walk, run. And I think, you know, over the last couple of years, we've crawled. And because of all those learnings and those experiences across the world, we're now increasing not just the capability of the vehicles and the features on the vehicles and responding to what customers and consumers are really asking for, but we've also fundamentally responded to the complexity of the environments within which we're comfortable deploying the vehicle safely. Because at the end of the day, to build consumer confidence and trust, you have to be safe. And I think those are some of the takeaways of our deployments over the last several years around the world.
You talk about safety. You talk about regulation. In fact, earlier this month in the pages of Automotive News, we wrote about some of the progress Local Motors is making around 3D printing and safety and impact zones in the vehicle at higher speeds. From a regulatory perspective, where are we in terms of autonomous vehicle technology and even regulation around safety standards of 3D printed components, 3D printed vehicles, larger systems? What's the state of regulation when it comes to that technology in the United States and even other parts of the world?
All right. So, Steve, here's what when I started with Local Motors, actually, I was working for the mayor of Detroit, Mike Duggan, in 2014, when through the work of a good friend of mine who at the time was at the White House, Kerry Duggan, and was part of the federal working group working with the city of Detroit and the state of Michigan as Detroit was going through bankruptcy. That's where I actually got introduced to Jay Rogers, the CEO and co-founder of Local Motors. And, you know, when he recruited me to come to Local Motors, had I known that I was going to write a dissertation on, or I could write a dissertation on the issues and challenges facing legislation and regulation in this space, I don't know if I would have taken the job. But being where we are, let me try to not talk at the complexity of a PhD dissertation, but try to boil it down. And there's really, to me, two fundamental layers. One, there's the state local layer, which traditionally has been responsible for the permitting, registration, insurance, and traffic law enforcement within the United States specifically. And frankly, that's similar kind of at a EU level versus a member country level, where the member country is equivalent to a state to a certain extent, and then the EU, the European Commission, is equivalent kind of to US DOT, NHTSA, not quite one-to-one, but where the federal government or the EU is responsible for the safety standards. And I think for us, it's a particularly challenging intersection because not only are we introducing autonomy, we're introducing a completely different class of vehicle for which currently, not just in the United States, but across the world, there doesn't exist a vehicle classification that neatly fits within this vehicle that we've developed. Or the vehicle that we've developed doesn't fit neatly within one of those existing classifications, nor the associated test standards. And then the third thing that complicates that on top of it is the fact that we're using advanced and new novel materials and production processes. So I think at the first point of AV legislation, we have the issue where currently there's a hodgepodge of rules or lack of rules out there at the state level and no overall federal guidance. I know we've done now we're on version AV 4.0, where there's more and more, again, guidance being issued, but not necessarily clear legislation or rules. I think the second part, which is challenging for us, is the ability to come and develop new vehicle classifications and standards, right? For, and I know certainly some colleagues in this space have taken different approaches. Waymo generally retrofits FCA Pacifica, where they have a FMVSS certified and compliant vehicle because they're just retrofitting it with additional sensors, versus what, for example, we're doing or GM Cruise is doing with the Origin, which fundamentally doesn't have a steering wheel or brake pedals. And for that, no classification and no safety standards exist to test towards. And so these are the things that we're all working on. Fortunately, in some countries, especially in the EU, we've gotten to a path where we think we can homologate a vehicle later this year. And then the work that was highlighted by your publication in Automotive News, and I think Pete Bigelow did a really nice job teasing out some of these nuances. We talked about the things that we're doing to really improve the capability of the materials in our process and show that it's, from a safety perspective, is equivalent or even better than certain traditional processes. So I'll pause there because, again, I believe I could write a PhD dissertation on this issue, but there's a lot of layers to this particular topic, Steve.
Yeah, absolutely complex. And as you point out, it gets a little bit more complex if you look at this from a federal level or a national level, a state level, and even a local level. So when you think about then, any advice, right, if you're a federal policymaker, if you're a state policymaker, what do you think are the near-term areas that need to be tackled first from a regulation and policy perspective?
Right. Thank you, Steve. I think there's a couple of things. What we've worked on with a number of states, and I don't know if you've seen this, but recently we were selected by the US DOT and NHTSA to participate along with 8 other companies in 8 different states, some of which we have very long-standing relationships with and do current testing in the states, in the AV test initiative. I think the AV test initiative's primary focus is to make transparent to the general public what testing is happening and where and what impacts and what are the results, which I think goes to the first question of consumer confidence and consumer trust. So I think that's important because ultimately, whether at the local, state, or federal level, or even at the global UN level, consumer confidence and trust is critical to get lawmakers to move forward. Right. I think the AV Start and the AV Safe initiatives from a couple of years ago in the last Congress didn't get legs because a lot of safety advocates were opposing this due to the fact that they felt there was not a lot of consumer education. So I think that's critical. And I applaud NHTSA in their effort to provide more transparency to that. At the local level, I can give you a very specific example. In the state of Maryland, where we work closely with the Motor Vehicle Administrator, Chrissy Neiser, and the Secretary of Transportation, previous one, Pete Ron, and even now his predecessor, on the fact that in Maryland, they determined that they didn't need to change the law in order to get autonomous vehicles on their roads. So what they decided is they were not going to go pursue new legislation in order to go and potentially put hurdles in front of companies to put vehicles on the road to test them. They said, hey, we can work within our current framework to put AV permits, testing permits out there for companies. And I think that's oftentimes one of the key points that we find for success is if you don't have to introduce laws, if you can operate within your current framework, find a path to enable that, because that, I think, helps as the technology matures, to get to a point where once the technology matures and there's more adoption or adapting of the technology and more deployments, then we can truly tailor rules and laws based on what the market demands rather than what some initial testing or theory supposes it should be. So again, being technology neutral and letting the market determine what should be the best use of the technology.
So let's turn to technology maturity around the manufacturing process. I remember like it was yesterday walking the floor at charity preview of the 2015 North American International Auto Show and Local Motors' giant 3D printer right there on the main floor. Since then, how has the technology matured? How has it scaled? What's the path forward relative to 3D printing in automotive? Has the business case been made in your point of view?
It certainly has been made for us at a low volume. Right. And so I'm not going to speak for large scale additive and 3D printing in general for the traditional automakers. I'm sure in a variety of ways they have continued to evaluate the process and the technology. But I can tell you where we were in 2014, 2015, when we did the world's first 3D printed vehicle, the Stradi at IMTS in Chicago in September of 2014. And then we repeated that at the auto show in 2015. Essentially, we were printing at probably 30 pounds an hour and were able to, when we started with the Ali, do about 30% of the body using 3D printing and additive processes. Fast forward to 2019 when we started series production of the Ali 2.0 in July in Knoxville. We are now printing at anywhere between 180 to 200 pounds an hour. Ali is now by weight or volume, depends slightly different, but it's in excess of 70% 3D printed or additively manufactured. We've reduced parts counts from Ali 1.0 to 2.0 by 50%, and we've taken out over 50% of manual production hours from Ali 1.0 to 2.0. For us, it takes less than 10 hours to print roughly 2,000 pounds of material and to mill, right, so both the additive and the subtractive part. And what used to be two different machines, an additive print part from the printer and a subtractive part from a CNC router, is now has been combined in one machine. So overall, we're looking that once we get back into steady state production, which unfortunately we've suspended for the last several months due to the current COVID crisis and pandemic, our target is to be able to produce 250 vehicles per year on one line, i.e. one printer and one shift. And we can do that on a less than 10,000 square foot manufacturing cell. So that is pretty impressive. There's other numbers I can go into, but in just five short years, we went from, 3D printing at 30 pounds an hour and taking 50 hours for about an 1,100-pound structure ballpark with including assembly time, to now being able to do a 2,000-pound structure in less than 10 hours. So that's the progress, and I think the business case for us on a low-volume, highly complex vehicle like the Ali, especially the Ali 2.0, which we've entered into series production in, makes sense.
So let's close with one more question around public-private partnerships. You mentioned a little bit before your deployment with the state of Maryland. What are you learning? What has surprised you with establishing these public-private partnerships? And again, what advice would you give to others?
So we believe that in this path forward for autonomy, we really value the collaboration between local, state, and federal. And we have, again, to the name of Local Motors, worked very closely. When we were in Maryland, you know, we got involved with the public safety team, with the Department of Public Works and Transportation, as well as with the state. And we worked very closely, even to the point where at one point, Prince George's County, right outside of Washington, D.C., as the scooter craze was hitting Washington, D.C. in 2018, Prince George's County was like, no, we need a local permit for scooters. And as part of that effort, they wanted to actually require us to have a local permit for autonomous vehicles. And frankly, I went back to the AV working group and the motor vehicle administrator and said, Chrissy, I think you're going down a dangerous road if you're going to allow each county to develop permits for each mode of transportation, because now I'm dealing with 52 counties in the state of Maryland plus 52 states, including DC and Puerto Rico, at a federal level. And it's going to get very hard. So I think the point is there needs to be very good alignment between what is the requirement locally and at the state level to permit and allow vehicles on public roads, and then what is the safety requirement that's mandated at the federal level to allow vehicles to be homologated. And the better and closer the collaboration is, I think the more streamlined we can go and put products to market. So we really have, you know, great relationships in the state of Maryland, but, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention Randy Iwasaki and the work we're doing with CCTA and GoMentum in California, as well as our partners at the state of Georgia and Peachtree City, where we really worked collaboratively with state leaders and local leaders. Another great example is Lewis Stewart and the city of Sacramento, where we actually did, I think, three total deployments as part of our fleet challenge. And what I believe is everybody wants to learn and wants to move this technology forward. Obviously, we have to build consumer confidence. And there's different use cases. You know, an Origin or a Waymo vehicle is a different use case than ultimately an Ali or even a May Mobility or an Optimus Ride. I think there's space in the market for a lot of these use cases to be validated and tested. And the collaboration and working together, and my point is, you know, if we all do a little bit, no one person has to do a lot. And I think that's the lesson, is we all have to do our part. We all have to try to play in the sandbox and be able to keep the focus on safely deploying this technology, but also not just trying to protect the status quo. Because protecting the status quo and hiding behind safety and saying, well, when is this technology safe enough, will cause us to make or slow down progress, versus if we're acknowledged that safety is paramount, but we have to be able to put the technology onto public roads, into the environment where we want to deploy it. And we just have to safeguard within that environment to ensure public safety. So that's what I would share as kind of our lessons learned.
David, I think the theme of we're in this together is extremely apropos given the state of the world that we find ourselves in right now, and I think a terrific way to conclude today's discussion. Thank you for joining us. Good to catch up, and we will talk soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Always a pleasure, and all the best in your other episodes.
That's Daily Drive for Thursday, July 23rd. For breaking news, go to autonews.com. And to catch up on nearly 100 stories, go to autonews.com/daily drive. We'll be back Friday. And now, some words from our sponsor.
Give inventory an express one-way ticket off your lot with TradeRev, the dealer-to-dealer digital auction platform revolutionizing automotive sales. Selling with TradeRev gives you the speed, ease, and convenience of a live digital auction combined with the power and scale of ADESA's physical and digital marketplaces. Why settle for a single-channel solution when TradeRev and ADESA give you so much more? ADESA and TradeRev's combined buyer base is 150,000 strong, meaning you get more eyes, more bids, and more money on every sale. TradeRev helps you move fast. Launch digital auctions in minutes right from your lot and send non-sales off-site to sell through ADESA's digital and physical channels. TradeRev understands your bottom line. Get every dollar out of your trades with profits that consistently beat the industry average. Enjoy peace of mind. No arbitrations and no hassles with TradeRev's optional seller protection plan. Start selling with TradeRev today and watch your auction inventory ride off into the sunset. Learn more about our pricing plans and introductory sale fees as low as $0 at traderev.com/gone and join the revolution today. That's TradeRev, TradeRev.com/gone.